Everybody is here. I'm Bill Balcom. Next to me is Nori Miller. And over here is, I believe it's David Greenberg. And both of you seem to be involved somehow with architecture. I'm merely a musician. And I don't really quite know what I'm to talk about the media, except I have a few thoughts about it. And I've also been asked to somehow deal with the integration of the media and ourselves. Recently, I happened to read an article, and I wish I had made notes of it more carefully, by a computer scientist, a very prominent one, who's at Columbia in New York. And he had said that we have really misunderstood several things about our own particular creation up to now, and that is where we are organic creatures and we feed ourselves by, oh my, let's wait for this. Well, all right, back. Well, we are actually organic creatures, and like the rest of the mammals and other animals on the earth, we feed ourselves actually by food that we have created a large number of creatures which are in their own ways also alive, except they're powered by electricity, or they're by gasoline, or in other words, other sorts of things. And the fact is that these actually possess life in some strange way as much as we do. In other words, any engine or any electronic gizmo is actually a living creature insofar as we are feeding it, and it must be fed in the same kind of way. That was one interesting thing. In other words, we're really driving a live automobile. We're turning on a live television set. These are all creatures, each of which have a certain amount of individuality and individuation, despite the fact that we have made them all in some sort of a mass-produced environment. So the point being that we really have already created something, which, although it isn't life in the same kind of way that we are, it really does have some of the attributes of life, even though they are probably robotic and simplified and smaller in application than any one of us, and so on. He said that the great advantage of this whole world of creation is that it does not have in its own potential any of our old atavistic fight and flight, similar kinds of, you know, things that we're constantly worrying about in our own way, our tendency toward war, our tendency toward killing each other, our tendency to overusing the environment, and so on and so forth, because these things aren't built in to the computer or built into any kind of electronic device or any kind of engine. And so then in the end, the world that is built by these creatures, as it looks increasingly it might be, will not have the troubles that ours have, because there won't be any emotion involved. Well, all right, now how does this involve with the question of us and the media? Well, let's take some of the very most pervasive phenomena in the media, for example, mostly television. And all of us now are living in a world of television. I was born before television, and many of us in this room were born and remember what it was like before television. But there is, of course, a large number of people who have known nothing else but. And the actual facts of the machine that we have in our homes, how it operates, what it does to us, the fascination of it, and even the way how it cuts up time, the way that we have somehow accepted as some of our basic, you know, language norms, the effect of film cutting, the fact that there are juxtapositions rather than perhaps a long kind of exposition of any kind of thought. We are not ready, as the 19th century was, to have a story told to us detail by detail by detail in some slow and rolling sequence, but rather something that's done in a very quick telegraphic fashion without any need toward transitions. The transitions that used to be, for example, in the older filmic medium, the dissolves and things like that, for example, don't seem to exist hardly anymore, except in the sense of sort of a nostalgic reminiscence of what films used to be back in the old days, when we did have to have dissolves. We have a very quick kind of thing. This has done something to us. It has cut us into a certain kind of rhythm, which has had a definite effect upon us. And this, I probably would be one most immediate kind of things. Why have I been so fascinated by this? Because as a composer, I've had some insight as to what this has done to the musical form of a musical piece. Whereas perhaps maybe in a large Beethoven symphony, take something like the Eroica, which is a very large, hugely built, carefully balanced structure, something that does have a sense of a very strong beginning. I'm taking the opening movement of it, if you're familiar with it. And it is a very, very long, extended kind of thing, built on balances, built on a sense of sequence, a sense of beginning, and a sense of end, and a certain sense of kind of a natural, what seems to at least the 19th century, kind of progression of events, each of which are important in a plot sense toward the end of the thing. That might be considered one polar opposite to what might be considered now a more likely kind of form, that is to say, that the unrolling of time, that is by cuts, by sudden moments, by juxtapositions, by perhaps maybe a lack of interest in an overall structure, but rather by momentary kind of form. And this has had some effect, I think, on probably all of us. We tend to think in this kind of way. One of the reasons that commercial television, which is a prominent kind of television in the United States, is closer to the lifestyle of most people, is because it is so fragmented, because it also doesn't require us to be there all the time. I'm sitting there watching a public TV movie. It's The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. They are replaying it, an old 1919 movie. And my wife says, God, I'd like to go to the bathroom. I can't do it. Now, with the commercial TV, one can. You go get yourself a snack. There's other kind of things. The telephone rings and so on. And we're dealing with a very discontinuous kind of life. The form has that same discontinuity. Now, this is good and this is bad. There are certainly, it means, obviously, a different kind of texture in our use of time in our media. It certainly shows one very important thing, that the media itself is strange and implacable in that somehow it's natural to it to do so. It isn't important to television what it is showing. No television set gives a tinker's damn what it is broadcasting at that particular point. It is just simply there being a receptor. It is showing us what all of the electronic impulses look like on our screen. They don't care particularly what's on them. Now, I think that probably this is part of the reasons why, as it happens, because of the way it seems to be made, because of the fragmentation of the thing, because of the one-pointedness of it too, that we are dealing with a different way of handling time. Now, what I'm struggling with as a composer and as a musician and as a performer and as a general involved person with whole kind of society is how I can cope with this change in the handling of time, in the handling of moment A to moment B, from now to then, because I think this has enormous implications on how we do tell a musical story, how a thing happens to unroll in events. And this is, of course, my basic dealing with, and that is dealing with time. And, of course, this is why I've always been asked to talk about this situation of the integrating the habit in the environs, because we certainly must take into account what these things have done to us. How much do we want to have them continue to influence us without any kind of feedback on our own? How can we deal with this seemingly fragmented unrolling of time and find some sort of higher unity so that we can really be able to deal with a more coherent kind of structure? We can tell what has to be said in a more complex and full way. How can we, in other words, deal with this thing so it is no longer our master, but we can make it happen for ourselves?
Very, very briefly. The only thing is, I think that it's sometimes dangerous to regard things which are developing and things which are changing as necessarily evil.
I didn't say it was.
No. But I mean, I think one can look at what television does and say, okay, what is that doing? That this is part of a process. I think you can see the kids can learn very much faster than they could at a certain time and accumulate a great deal of information very, very quickly and very, very concisely. Mm-hmm. And I think television is teaching that rather than schools. And this may be good, this may be not. Their attention span is certainly a great deal less. But what happens is that people change and are influenced and create that influence.
What I'm talking about, of course, is it's going to be easier to deal with this, I think. I can't bother to...
Good, take it away.
Let's take it that way, okay? And then we can both get into it. I says, what I'm talking about, of course, is the nature of what we learn and how we learn and how it's been changed. And I'm trying to understand this in the light of how it has influenced us. I mean, what you're saying is that television is a wonderful teacher, but it's a teacher of a different sort than a person getting up in front of a class or a person reading a book which starts on page one and ends on page 500, and we go through this very carefully linear kind of thing. Now, we've been told, and probably rightfully, that the old linearity is a thing of the past, and that we should now start looking at things in a much more global kind of way. And I think some of this is true. I'm not saying that this isn't necessarily the natural next move. What I'm interested in is in the details of how this has changed our perception.
Exactly yeah. What I was trying to say. David, you've been making notes.
Should I say something? Make a statement? For about in the first place, the subject being integrating habitat, environs, and media. It's obvious to me that that's what this is. That's what we're doing now, kind of in an experimental way here up at Solaris. It's a pity there aren't more experiments like this available to more people, where these are the subjects and where people, you know, get involved in thinking about these things. And I think the integrating of the habitat, the environment, the environs, and the media. I think the glue is the people. If this is going to happen, it's going to happen through the people. In other words, for the most part, I don't think that the media will ever become anything more important than it already is by itself. But somehow, with some process of the people taking part in some way. And the environs, people have to take part in that. And there are some that say that people do take part in that. For instance, I heard an interesting lecture by Paul Rudolph recently in Los Angeles where he refers to everybody, for instance, in the city of Los Angeles, that they are all urban designers. And that the person who's mowing their lawn is an urban designer and is involved in the process of dealing with the environs. The media, to touch on some things that you've said about the media, I think that the media has an incredible potential to learn. It exists for anybody to learn from. It exists right now. I think also the environment has an equal incredible potential for people to learn from. In other words, if you go out in the morning, you get up in the morning, you go out into Los Angeles or any major city in the world, and you decide that you're going to start learning from it and go around and looking very carefully, then you will learn from it. One of the interesting things that happened in the 60s, near the end of the 60s, when multimedia was real big and they were doing all these multimedia shows and all that, and then a lot of people kind of backed off at it at one point because they were afraid of media overload, you can watch too much TV or you can too many TVs on at the same time and radios and stuff. I think what really happens, and Marshall McLuhan has done some studies on this, there is no such thing as media overload when it comes to people. In other words, machines overload. People don't overload. What happens if you happen to be watching a multimedia show or two or three movies at the same time or two or three stations at the same time, or if you happen to be just driving through Los Angeles on freeways very fast and happen to be very observant and, you know, or looking around a lot. What happens is one doesn't overload. What happens is one sort of goes on to the next level. One no longer... What happens is that you almost subconsciously you start going into this other gear, and that other gear is a kind of a pattern recognition. And when you're watching television in the ways that you have to watch commercial television these days, and not only are you broken up by commercials, but a lot of people keep switching the stations. And what happens is, and you're still learning, even though there's these little, I think even more so, because I think television allows you to go on to this next level of pattern recognition, which is beyond any of the, you know, sort of the linear ways of learning. And you don't learn in the way where you come up with answers or anything, but you learn in the way where you're constantly, you know, turning your own mind into a... almost a useful computer in a sense, and you're just taking in the perceptions, mm-hmm. and you're not what television. I think what television has allowed the younger generation to do, which has not really been allowed previously because of such linear qualities to the arts and to the cities and everything. And what television has allowed is a kind of a just percepts. In other words, you watch it and you get this perception or that perception. I don't think television really deals with concepts. I think it's alien to that media. I don't think the city of today, the 20th century city, Los Angeles, Houston or whatever, Las Vegas, it's the same kind of, it's the same sort of kind of thing. You're kind of learning, they're not concepts. I mean, Los Angeles is not a concept. There are some 19th century cities that are concepts. What McLuhan says, which is kind of interesting, which I've been very much influenced by lately, is that concepts really aren't, they don't do you much good these days, because everything is going so fast that by the time you've really formulated a concept on something, it's changed, the world has changed, it changes too fast. And that really the way to learn, the way to perceive the environment, the media, the habitation, is a kind of you don't even try to make up concepts. You just take these percepts, and that they eventually, if you take in enough, and you have to take them without making any judgments. You just have to look at the, and then they will become patterns. And I think the media, as well as the 20th century city, whether it's American or not, I think is really allowing us to learn in a whole different way and to make more kind of intuitive to relate to things more intuitively rather than kind of intellectually, conceptually putting together. Concepts take too long. It's not valid by the time you figure it out. And that I think that that's that the city can teach us and the media can teach us about this sort of, this other level of thinking. And I think this is the kind of thinking that I think will get us into the future. And if we're not able to think, if we're not able to flow with the processes that we can, you know, like that the media presents us with, or the contemporary city, then we won't get to the next century. And that the way we're going to get there is just letting it happen for a while and just letting it through and taking these perceptions, and eventually it'll turn into something, I think.
Well,
I feel positive.
This is the problem I think many of us face, is that we have really, at least in many cases, I know I have, gone through that process. I've tried the just general wash. I've sat there and had a wonderful time being passive and went through it all, watched the whole thing, tried the experiences, having sat there and have done it for a good long time. You know what? I'm bloody bored. I'm tired, really, of just sitting there being a passive animal, watching it all and going with the flow. I really am. I'm tired of it because I feel that it is not humanly satisfying to me as an animal as I exist. I haven't yet learned how to become a computer. I have not yet learned to become the machine that this man at Columbia says is probably an ideal state.
And don't you think that the world in general has reached that point? Don't you think this active interest in sports is an example of something which is far beyond you?
Why sports? Why particularly sports?
No. What I mean is that the world seemed to enjoy passive mm-hmm. activities for quite some time, mm-hmm. and suddenly the interest in running and tennis and all these other things mm-hmm. seems to indicate a change.
Well, it's for several reasons. Obviously, it's also a kind of a biofeedback of a kind. I mean, you feel something by running. You go through all these things. You feel all these things, and it's all still a very private experience. But there are also communal experiences that can be had and can be continued to be having. One of the facts that we're all sitting here means, I suppose, you're looking for someone, and you're looking for some one kind of communal experience that we're all to be here to have.
But we have communal experiences with television. I mean,
I haven't said that it's not possible, and I still love television. I love it for what it can do. First of all, I have to sit there, and I was robbed a couple of times, and recently the insurance man was very kind, and he gave me enough money for a first-rate television, so I got a beautiful Sony at home, and it makes absolutely wonderful pictures. And I must say, I have to get over, I mean, they're jewel-like, the clarity is gorgeous. And I sit there in awe of the technological marvel that's right in front of my room there, and I keep thinking, well, what dreck I have to watch in order to watch these beautiful pictures? And I've seen so many things, and you're dealing now with a person who's immersed himself from having never had television, from sort of hating it, from growing up as a musician, where the point I had really spent all those early years of my life practicing and composing and being involved with an entirely different kind of wash, a kind of wash of, you know, a constant music going through the head, which is what is still my first experience. My basic language will always be music. I'm a musician. I'm a born and bred musician. But I'm fascinated by the time relations in television, because they in that way are alike music in what's happened to music, because of the fact that you're dealing with this fragmentary experience. And what I'm saying now is there any way we can deal now with the body politic in some other kind of way? The ultimate ultimate experience to me for television, I don't know why I come back to television a lot, but it does have something to do with it, is I sort of a metaphor I come up with. Here we are in a 5 foot square room, 5 foot tall, 5 foot wide, 5 foot high, everything. And in front of this one man sitting in that little tiny room is a television, and he is there by himself. And all through the building is more little cubicles, very much with the same kind of people. In other words, it can also have a very private quality. It tends to turn us back into single people again. A runner runs really by himself, although he may do so in a marathon. What I miss, maybe it's very old-fashioned of me, is the great communal experiences I remember as a musician. The moments where I was there as in an audience or there as a musician, dealing with a large number of people, where we could find a certain kind of commonality among us as people. I feel this is an important kind of thing. How can we do this still dealing with the explanations of our perception that the television can bring? We can juxtapose now. We can make terrific jumps. We can be elliptical in a way that we couldn't be with the older art. And I still think that this is possible to do without having to deal with being old-fashioned about it. I don't have to tell the story in the complete way I might have once had to.
We keep talking about media as if it were only television. I think we can be very free to regard the various arts as media and to look at what's happening there. And I think one of the things television has done and all the discussion of television is it's gotten us to regard many, many things as media, as conduits from one point to another point that we never would have before. And certain things are happening. People have begun to be interested in and to demand some kind of ideal, some kind of sense of purpose from art, from architecture, from writing. There's a man, I wanted to read a few quotes, who just wrote a book on fiction called John Gardner. He's a reasonably well-known novelist. And he's come out very strongly against the fiction that's been written essentially post-war in America as being formalistic, as being self-indulgent. And he makes some claims for what art, specifically novels, but any kind of art has to be as a media, which I think one is beginning to see in architecture as well, and therefore interesting. He says it reasonably well. All those criticisms of other novelists may be self-serving, but I wanted to read a couple. Art is essentially, I don't know if I can compete here, art is essentially serious and beneficial, a game played against chaos and death. Art builds temporary walls against life's leveling force, the ruin of what is splendidly unnatural in us, consciousness. A good book is one that, for its time, is wise, sane, and magical, one that clarifies life and tends to improve it. True art treats ideals, affirming and clarifying the good, the true, and the beautiful. True art establishes models of human action, casts nets towards the future, carefully judges our right and wrong directions, celebrates and mourns. It does not rant. It does not sneer or giggle in the face of death. It invents prayers and weapons. It designs visions worth trying to make fact. It does not whimper or cower or throw up its hands and bat its lashes. I think these are claims for the media of novels that wouldn't have been made 15 years ago. And I think the same kind of thing we're seeing in architecture. We're talking about architecture that has meaning, that puts forth social ideals, that puts forth political ideals, that enlarges the human being. Frank Gehry's work in Los Angeles, the Ron Davis House is probably the best known, plays with one's perception so as to make one much more aware of what one's looking at and how your eyes work and what kinds of things we understand. And that's on the just the barest level. Jenks.
How can architecture ever compete with television to do what you're saying? It's impossible. It doesn't have the range of colors. It doesn't have, I mean, once in a while an architect may do something.
I don't see why we need to think in militaristic terms of competition.
I don't either. All I really want to do is to find out what's happening to us in the process of what these wonderful things we've invented, what they're doing to us. And what we can do then.
Well, wait a second. You portray the person watching television as this passive person in front of this box all by himself. Yeah. Actually, this person watching television is joined by about 25 million other people at the same time, which is a rarity in history anyway to begin with. He's not really by himself on one level. But the main point I want to make right now is that the fact is the person who sits and watches television passively is the person that will go through life and do everything passively, whether he's in school, whether he's in church, whether he, I mean, a passive person will be passive no matter what in what environment he is in. And that I think there are a lot of people who watch television, I mean, like I do, and I mean...
Look, I'm not against passivity. I'm not making any value judgments. I just want to know what it is that's happening to us. I don't want to deal with it in that kind of way in saying that this is wrong or this is right. The ultimate horror would be that we would become sort of cut off, that even if we're 25 million people watching the same television show and we are all by ourselves doing it, we are still by ourselves. And the whole situation of us with other human beings in proximity, which is a very natural state for human beings to be in, if the, maybe even that's debatable.
I want to just interrupt for 1 second and throw out a real big five-letter word, truth. And there was something before in the theological stuff where they were talking about understanding the past, and someone even suggested understanding the present as being an important thing to get us to the future. To me, understanding the I spent a little time trying to understand the past, and don't know if I totally understand it, but I've spent a lot of time very recently, in the last 10 years, trying to understand the present. One of the things that Louis Kahn once said was, L.A. is truth, whether you like it or not. And I went around for a few years trying to figure out what he meant by that. I got a little help from Werman, who used to be associated with him in some ways, and he said that Louis Kahn's definition of truth was that people are truth. And I imagined after a while that what he meant by L.A. as being truth is that L.A. is a kind of an environment, a city where people can express themselves individually. They can drive any color car they want, wear any color clothes, they can live in any color house they want. And, I mean, and it's not just colors. I mean, whatever their style or whatever it is, they can do it. So it's a, kind of the truth sort of hangs out. It looks a little crazy, looks a little eclectic. In some ways, you know, you have to say that I'm wearing this shirt as a joke, but almost ABC is truth because more millions and millions and millions and millions of people are watching ABC than the other things. And there's a kind of, I think what I feel that I have to deal with is that the sudden recognition that you know, maybe people are truth. And if they like the Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and what's the third big one, you know,
yep.
There's got to be something there. I mean, you can't just say, okay, that's dumb stuff, and people are dumb, and forget about it. I mean, someone has to really understand what is that phenomena, and what is bringing people together in
a way. Well, I think we agree in that. Huh? I mean, I haven't automatically made a value judgment, nor do I think a lot of other people
have. Or about a city where like L.A. is like television. I mean, where people are, you know, they're really doing what they really want to do. As architects or musicians, mm-hmm. how do we help or help these people grow? And where they're living in LA, or how do we help them watch television? But I think that for me, I mean, that's a given. LA is a given, and television is a given. And, you know, I don't think of either one as being particularly good or bad. When it comes to truth, it doesn't come to good or bad. It's just true. It's what is, you know. And, you know, dealing with what is the secret to integrating it all. And no one's really begun to deal with what is. And that's, I think, the basic point.
Well, I don't think that we're in any terrible disagreement about that. I mean, I don't think it's automatically right, for example, to assume that that commercial television and what might be considered its worst quote-unquote manifestations is any worse, so to speak, than public TV. In fact, actually, I have more of a brief against the public TV than I have the other, for the obvious reason that I feel that I think what's made is a terrific mistake about the nature of television. It also, I think, tends to have, at least in my experiences that I've had it, I mean, I've had quite a bit of work with public TV, is that it tends to, you know, disallow some of the basic nature of the medium, such as the need that we all have when we're in our own home to take breaks, to move around, to take care of other kind of things, even to move our bodies. If you're sitting in a room with a group of other people, and you are in the throes of, say, something like the St. Matthew Passion, and you're sitting there for 4 hours, you may want to go to the bathroom, but you forget about it because you're obviously in some other kind of a thing. One of the things that holds you there, and as strong as it does, is the presence of thousands of other people around you, and they are feeling something of the same kind of thing as you are. There are also the hundreds of people up on stage helping the whole thing happen, and the overall incredibly moving experience that this can become. And when this is denied us, for too long a time, there is a very strong and important and inviolate part of the human being, which is being ignored and being atrophied. And I don't lament it necessarily, because I don't think we can go back to the St. Matthew Passion. I think we've become another kind of person. But I do know that we're able to sustain a long kind of thing. People go to football games, which are just as long as the St. Matthew Passion. And there's no problem with that. They seem to stay with that. But what I'm saying is that what I need, and I think we all need, is a sense of greater flexibility in all of the different things. And that comes from understanding which each one of these media are. I think you're right in saying that each one of them is a medium, that we have a concert medium. There's a rock concert medium, the classical concert medium. We have a medium of going to a gallery and watching what painters are doing. We have the medium of going into a house and seeing what's been done there. All these are different media. And what can happen is that the problem with television is that for a very large number of people, there has been a tendency, I think, to be only able to understand the world around them in terms of the very fragmented nature of that medium. That's all. I don't have much else to say about this.
Isa, I want to say that I'm very jealous of the fact that you're a musician. Somehow music is the one art that somehow works, can work anywhere, anytime. It can fit in anywhere, anytime. But, you know, like, let's say an artist who does a painting or a sculpture or something, I mean, it's a tremendous amount of problem for him to put that anywhere. And somehow music so easily fits everywhere, anytime, any age, any, you know, it's sort of this really special medium that somehow has always worked and will always work and it will always be loved and it means more to, almost than any other medium. You know, there's something very special about music. How does it stand? I mean, it comes up sometimes. You must know what I'm talking about a little bit. And it's, there's something so special about music that none of the other arts have ever gotten to that point. Is it impossible? Is it just music? I mean, that man is certainly, through music, has hit his highest, you know, creative, you know, levels and most, I mean, I think, am I wrong?
I would like to ask you a Beethoven's question about Cortez. Music.
All right.
It's very clear in art and architecture and literature and film, which I pay most attention to, the kinds of new demands about what we want, the reaction against abstraction or abstraction in its own as anything but a tool, as an end. Is there some parallel development in music? Does that make any sense in musical terms?
The reaction against what became a sort of a very strong abstractification of our own medium, yes, there has been. In fact, it's very similar in a lot of ways. I think this comes from the fact that I suppose you could say the same certainly is true in the biggest revolutionary changes in architecture and in music and in painting were all just about 1910, 15, 20, right? I mean, there was a certain kind of period
between
in there.
Between the wars.
Yeah, but, you know, and you know, at, you know, and before the First World War and after it, too, and around that time. That was where there was a terrific need, I think, to break down a lot of other the norms of society. We couldn't continue with the 19th century concept, as David has pointed out. So there was a need to try to deal with all kinds of fragmentation. Most of it was very analytical, I think, in certain ways. It was beginning to look at different things which we had only considered as part of a bigger picture and somehow reify them, look into them as separate elements to be understood in other ways than one. And certainly this happened with music. We began to want to deal with, in that particular language, tonality, which is to say key-centered. That was a very determinist thing, particularly in the day of Mozart, where everybody knows exactly where a key is, when you've been away from it, when you're coming back to it. Mother, I've come back to you at the end of the piece. You know, you always do finish the piece in the same key you started it. There's a structure that's built on that whole kind of key plan. There is a whole sense of gravity involved, which is something that is absolutely perceptible to any Western ears. Even in the Eastern music, there is also certain scale tones which are considered home. And there is, in other words, a sense of home and away. And this was, of course, very central to the whole basic musical thing. And there was a need, I think, around that particular time to break all this down, to say, what should we do about deciding each one of these key centers could be considered equally? The whole effort by Arnold Schoenberg was not to destroy tonality, but to unify all 12 possible tonalities into an area in which there were no home, that they were all home, that there was no sense of gravity, there was no sense of away and home, that it was all really home all the time, and that a really understanding here of this particular idiom would be immediately to the point where you're talking about, you know, perceiving patterns particularly. Well, patterns was really where our ears began to concentrate. We began to deal with, and there was a kind of a surface level of basic kind of things. And this, of course, is what happened to us. And eventually out of this, if you began to look at the pattern hard enough, you might be able to extrapolate the whole title thing. Whereas a classical music ear one that was built in the 19th century or the late 18th century would be first articulating the structure and then the parts of the structure inside of that structure.
This is interesting what you say. Why is it that music is the only art where people can just let the patterns come in, not make judgments with every note or every little bit? In other words, when it comes to a visual thing, there every little thing is a judgment or something
like
that.
Well, that's because actually,
and the music, you can just sit back and you can let it come in. And
I think you're talking about yourself. I think as a musician, I listen to music in quite a different way. I listen to, I'm sure you're a much more visually oriented person, and I'm sure that you look at visual things more structurally perhaps than I do. But I've looked at music structurally because of my training, because of my orientation, because I think in the language of music, and eventually anyone who creates in it does think in these overall structures, doesn't think on purely on a single moment of what I can do between this measure and that measure. I listened to one of the drummers out there who was able to place against a 4-beat, a 3-beat, and an 8-beat, and a 3-beat against that. And that, of course, is structurally interesting on a momentary basis. Now the next interesting part is what makes him a good musician is he was able to structure the whole solo from the beginning to the end so that the idea continued to have extra ramifications. He began to vary it. He began to have it go to a kind of a strong upward building kind of shape. And these are the things that, in other words, give it more than just that moment. If it were just the pattern of the 4 versus against the 3, against the 8, against a free pattern, it would soon lose its interest. It's got to have some sort of overall kind of shape before it becomes coherent in a long kind of sense. So in the process, you're asking about the abstractions that happened to us. Well, these, I think, a lot of it came from, at least in the case of music, from the various wars. This morning, several people mentioned, I think it was Bill Thompson was talking about Wagner as one of the, kind of the ultimate example of the overweeningly proud artist, the one who was so in love with his medium, was so able to create an overwhelming kind of masterpiece in it that you could be swept away in it. And we saw a case of a whole country which is metaphorically became sort of going down in the Wagnerian Götterdämmerung, having built almost its own structure on the same kind of pride and the same kind of thing. Now, I'm talking about the Third Reich, of course. But this, of course, in Europe had cataclysmic effects. Both wars asked of the people, actually, in a way, to war the old culture against the new culture, the older attitudes against what was clearly happening. And these, of course, happened to be terrible cataclysms in both cases. So the need after each war would be to start to break new ground. The one difference between probably what happened in architecture and art on one hand and what happened in music on the other hand, now, of course, there are exceptions. Think of Picasso, is that after the war, after all of the really mind-boggling, wild things that happened in the teens. I'm talking about the Rite of Spring in 1913, Piero Lunaire, all of the new ways of looking at music. Now we find Ives' Fourth Symphony, which was written, all of these works before the First World War, before the great cataclysms. After the war, there was the First World War now I'm talking about, a terrific return toward neoclassicism, a need to rearticulate the forms of the past, a need to go back to a Baroque era, a need to try to sound like Bach or like Mozart. A need to try to find a simple, straight kind of thing, which I think is different in that way from what had happened to you.
I was just wondering whether with half an hour left we wanted to open up the discussion to the audience.
I'd love to see that. Have you things to say? Please. I'm tired of talking. A little hard with this drum solo going on. No words or...
Questions?
Questions, anything? Yes. Come up here. I'm sorry to make you get up, but I mean,
I just would like to know how you feel about media being, I tend to agree with you that most of TV is sort of wasted, and I'd like to see if people are getting to the point where they're starting to feel like the environment that TV needs to be cleaned up and used more productively and effectively.
Yes, but I don't know about it being cleaned up.
Well, I mean...
I mean, I like it when it's dirty and messy and all over the place. I love that messiness of it all. But no, I think what I want to see is a greater understanding of...
Like when the robbers win, is this it?
What?
You like it when the robbers win?
I don't care about the robbers and the cops. I mean, I would like to see other things on TV than the unimaginativeness of a lot of it. And I see the same thing happening in people talk about the violence in TV. Well, and of course, there's violence in the movies. Last night I saw, the night before I saw Carrie on TV. That's about as violent as any movie I ever want to see. I don't think I'll want to see another one. All that blood and gore all over the floor. Well, I think it's a lack of imagination, probably, because they have to fill the medium. It's a voracious animal. You have to get on that darn thing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because they have to keep up thinking of something. They all seem to come to that. Why? I'm less interested, in other words, on the effect on the audience. I think the audience gets quickly inured to violence. What I'm interested in is in the practicing artists and TV people and those like that who are making all of that violence.
Well, I'm talking more about... I'm talking, in fact, that, you know, like artists don't have any control. It's basically... you know, the advertising agencies and all the money that pays for the commercials.
So why do they want it?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
What do you want?
Why do they want that? That's impossible. I want to hear that.
What is it you're saying?
Well, I'm saying...
Wait till he's finished. Sounds like the wind-up to me.
That must be it. Okay.
What I'm saying is... whether, you know, there ought to be some kind of a concerted effort by people to do something more creative with television rather than just leaving it like in the private domain. I'm saying there's that potential for using it much more creatively. As far as I'm concerned, I think it's right now it's evolving to the point where, you know, it's like the environment's going to be run down to the point where people are just going to have to take it over. But I'm saying why do we have to wait, you know, till the environment gets destroyed before you start doing something about it, you know?
I think one of the myths we have is the idea of an art form which serves some vague public interest as opposed to an art form which serves some monetary or political or religious interest. And I don't think you can really find any moment in history where artists, in fact, had any kind of control over what was being done. And I think that's something we pretend happened that we need to get back to.
But even when they are successful, like for instance in music, the Beatles were so successful in controlling the whole world in a way and changing the whole world. I mean, their music was, but I don't think they really did have control. In other words, the artist himself. I mean, maybe they slipped into.
The control had to do with marketing success.
Well, they also had
some
control.
No,
I think the interesting thing. I think the interesting thing.
They also had talent, you know, which helped.
I think the interesting thing is on the way over here, I heard someone introducing this music thing over there and saying that the drum and the music was man's first expression. And, you know, and I think that there's a very important thing happening in music which does make it so much more heavier than a lot of the other arts. And there's an unmistakable rhythm to music. And I think that there's that kind of a rhythm, and that rhythm can even sometimes come over on television set, no matter what's on TV. But that rhythm can start happening, and it affects you. And it's how does architecture get that rhythm? You know, make people feel that kind of basic rhythm that they want to be part of. And I think, you know, it comes down to rhythm in a way. And how do the arts relate to rhythm? And I think maybe they don't, and that's maybe one of the problems. And man needs rhythm. In a way, that's what I'm saying.
Well, rhythm isn't all there is to music. There are other things that are in music too. Basically, it's some kind of organization of sound, or all different kinds of them. If somebody is out playing a flute out by himself without a drum behind it, it's also music. When you're whistling to yourself, it's also music. There were also, after the Second World War, where there was a need, again, talking about the whole need to say goodbye to a whole part of European culture, which had brought them to this terrible, terrible moment. There was a need at that particular point to destroy, at least try to reinvent every one of the various aspects of music, which that became named parameters. I'm talking about the movement that was headed by people like Pierre Boulez, Karlheinz Stockhausen, and others, where the whole basic kind of rhythmically predictable kind of set, which had been so much part of music up to that particular time, was also called in question. So all of a sudden there were needs of trying to organize lengths of notes into all kinds of unrhythmic kinds of ways. There were needs of dealing with different kinds of sounds in some kind of freeing kind of way to get away from the old predictable kind of impulses. What you're talking about the rhythm is you're talking about the rhythm that's been prevalent in popular music.
No, I'm not talking about beat. I'm not talking about beat. I'm talking about rhythm. For instance, in the film Close Encounters, there's a kind of a sound. Actually, the sound is totally stolen from Ligeti's Atmospheres, and it's just one note that goes on for 3 minutes, and they use a piece of that note. And I'm not talking about a beat. I'm talking about a rhythm, no matter if the note is 4 minutes long. I'm not talking about
you're talking
beat.
About
I'm talking
the,
about rhythm.
You're I mean, talking about events, then. You're talking about a different kind of thing. You're talking about event followed by event by event. Now, of course, the one legacy of that whole particular period, which lasted about, maybe 15 or 20 years of what you call post-war music, more prevalently in Europe than it was here, was the legacy of long-held notes, the kind of sound that you're talking about in Close Encounters, or you could find it also in those other things. Well, of course, you hear it through, Los Angeles ears, but when I hear a thing like that, I keep thinking of the source, and I can't help because I heard the Ligeti when it came out, and it was a different kind of thing for me. I heard of it as a different kind of thing. I heard of it as musical events in an entirely different kind of way. I don't think of it as something that automatically means to me space. It has taken on that meaning through Hollywood.
Yes.
I think it's highly likely. I think video and that sort of thing lends itself to that. Again, I don't think music and architecture have to compete. I think you've made a very good case for architecture. I think music's
what do they call architecture frozen music? I always wanted to know that.
I don't think I like frozen music. Melted architecture.
Huh?
Some of us call music melted architecture.
Oh, okay.
Take another point of view on this.
Maybe architecture is frozen music. I don't know.
What they mean.
I don't like my music.
Is exactly what you're talking about in terms of the structure and the rhythm made into permanent form.
Architecture is supposed to have that.
Architecture always did until, and some say it has to do with the philosophy of architecture. It more specifically has to do with the percentage of money of a society that goes into building. Some basic things happen, and we're getting very nitty-gritty here for a moment, but some basic things happened in architecture. At some point, people started to pay workers a livable wage. This is an absolute disaster for architecture. It was much better for the workers.
That happened in music, too.
Not as crucial proportion, perhaps, or perhaps there was federal money and that sort of thing to make it up.
Musician unions are as much of a problem of integrating music into our culture.
Oh, I can tell you this is true, but I think the real destruction of the large ensembles, the things where they had the orchestras of very great, large numbers of orchestras, was the First World War. The real age of the great orchestra was before the First World War. The war simply killed off most of the instrumentalists.
And when you magnify the kind of money you're talking about in construction, it's even higher, and construction does not get private money given as a donation and the ball given to support the local building and the rest of that, like the Lyric Opera. There's a lot of situations which are different. In any case, what is then available, proportion of money available to go into things which are complicated, which is what you're talking about. Architecture which is complicated, which has funny little decorations, and which has breaks, and which has different materials, which has all the things that you call rhythm, became out of the question. At the same time, there are certain philosophies that made abstraction a good idea, that considered color and all this sort of thing necessary for the masses, but certainly the elite didn't need this sort of thing. Rationality is what was required. What's interesting now is that architecture has begun to get quite a bit interested in these things, in detail, in the sense of human invention, the sense of experience as you move through a building, smaller scale things, things which break up the experience as you go through. But the money still isn't there, and what you're getting are some very interesting compromises, which begin to look ticky-tacky a lot of the time, because the situation is built in, and it was not simply a question of philosophy ever. It's quite a bit off your point, but...
Well, in a way, it's sort of related. I mean, what we're talking about, for example, on the street in Europe, if you see one Bauhaus building among 10 or 12 other ones that were built around the corner, by the Belle Epoque time, when there's lots of... I mean, this is very noticeable in Paris, for example. One or two buildings that are very modern over in Passy, right next to things that were built in 1905, well, they have a very marvelous and natural and very shocking effect. But when you have a whole street like Park Avenue, all built rectilinearly with lots and lots of grays, glasses is another feeling entirely. I think what happened with art music, and I'm talking about art music mostly because this is what my interest was for many years, purely almost, we had an area in there where the very effects I talked about, the long-held notes, the things that you found so spacey in Close Encounters, the things that are, were a whole bunch, it was a whole language that hardly ever really got to us here, that hardly penetrated in a lot of ways that it did at one time in Europe. I'm talking about Boulez, Stockhausen, Berio, all these are the people who were very close involved at one particular time. With the kind of sound that was really supposed to say goodbye to all of the music of the past in an effort to try to start all over from scratch. Stockhausen described the Germany of after the war as a very exhilarating time because all of the cities which had any kind of memory of the Nazi time or all the years before that were flattened. Therefore, you had to start from scratch. You were forced to start from scratch. This was very exciting to them. Very exciting to many. There was a sense of building. Now, of course, what has happened is they've built, and now they're dealing with the world that they have then built, and the building is no longer as simple as, you're dealing with a kind of stagnation there, as so often happens elsewhere in our Western society. Because of the fact we end up with all these brand new cities. I remember when I used to work in the German theaters, and I was doing a lot of stage music in towns like Dortmund, Wuppertal, Essen, Düsseldorf, and like that. And I remember times I would wake up in the hotel room looking outside, I would see the Kaufhof, the Kaufhalle, and I couldn't really remember for several minutes which town I was in. They were all so much alike, because they'd all been built about the same kind of time. Well, we did end up, in other words, with a kind of a sort of an overall abstraction in our musical medium and art music, which made it all sound very much alike. It was kind of an international style, which sort of took over at that particular point. What has happened recently, which in a way is parallel to what happened to architecture, has been a greater intense interest in some of the effects of localization, popularization, even certain things. I've in the last 10 years been fascinated by a whole historical point of view toward popular music, into some sort of attempt to try to build an American musical language, which is based on some of the very simplest choices, whether a note goes up here, goes down there, things that are built almost because of the great songwriters or the great jazzmen, great ragtimers. These are people who have somehow had a great deal to do with basic steps, the one-to-one choices between note to note or pitch to pitch or sound to sound, which are so much part of American language. So I've needed to go into that and to find my own particular ability to accept the roots I had as a musician. A lot of this whole particular time was a sort of an internationalization, a sort of a need to deny any of the sort of what you might call more local types of acculturation in our lives. Our American culture is a very universal culture already, but they were already, when they were choosing those first notes, our great songwriters and jazzmen and ragtimers and other people, they were already making very basic choices which affect ours and have a great deal to do with what we do on the simplest kind of level. And I think many composers now and many musicians are looking really at these basic choices as something very important because they have a great deal to do with who we are and what we are. We can't deny them. We can't say they're not there. We can't become internationalists. I can never be a very good Boulez or a Berio or a Stockhausen because I was born here. I didn't go through the same Holocaust they did. I didn't go through the need to destroy the culture that they might have had. I didn't go through the same kind of thing. And because of this, I may be more interested because of there's never been any of those great big schisms in my life, as a roar would cause, that maybe in a way we have the freedom to be able to put together a culture back from the past to the present that perhaps Europe can't do right now. I see, for example, in art music in Europe right now, a rather dead-end situation. They are still dealing with some of the problems that are inherent in the language they discovered in the 1950s. A need to stay away from rhythms, a need to stay away from any kind of recognizable musical fragments, to the point now that that also has begun to turn around in tiny circles, and it begins to sound very much all the same. So here we are with a kind of a history. We're all immigrants, we're all Americans because we came here through one or another means. Either we were brought here in chains or we were not, we still all came here. And that broke something from Europe, but we have made our own kind of continuity. So in a way, we are carrying on another kind of longer tradition of music. Music is a growing language. Music is a language like language. It contains in it old sounds, old words, old meanings, and it contains things that have to be invented last week because of need. And all of these things are part of it, and a whole spectrum of language. This is, I'm talking myself, and what I want is to be able to use the entire musical language in some very cohesive and coherent kind of way, involving both the past and the present. In other words, the same language as I understand it, in the same way as I speak. In fact, I hope better than I speak.
Other questions?
Questions?
Comments?
Listen, we're going to ask questions. We're going to we're going to have a test here if there's no questions.
Yes.
Go right into the test period.
I'm surprised there aren't four people who thought the seminar should have been on something else. Yes.
Television is our drum. It's our culture's drum. I mean, just like it was millions of years ago, it's just our drum. Just like culture.
Louder, please. Sorry.
Comment too, and I think what we're seeing is a tremendous popularization of television. Video is actually, we're seeing a whole revolution going on right now, alternative types of television.
cable TV and stuff. There's also a resurgence of interest in short films, in animation, any number of
levels. Also, to more directly answer your question, I have been involved in for some years now in the use of video to understand the environment and understand how the ecology is getting ripped off. And they have some very recent technological developments that allow, for instance, time-lapse video, and where we've spent days and weeks and months looking at plazas and things and in different incrementing the time, which that was a very important thing you said at the beginning. Time has a very important part of understanding. And we are so in the, quote, real world as we go through our day. We are so, you know, we have our blinders, perception of chronological time. We can't pop out of that. We can't see it. We can't, you know, go, you know, a mile up in the air and look down. A video camera can go up there and look down for us, and it can show us ourselves at different time increments. I mean, for instance, if you look at a plaza 1/60th normal time, you will get a whole different, people will look like ants on one level. You change the time and media attack.
A feedback over in the mic. Yeah.
Incidentally, feedback, which is something the expression must come from media. One of the interesting things that Marshall McLuhan says, and it's the first thing we learn from media, is feedback, which we're getting right now. And it can teach you some things. But what he suggests is that feedback is too slow, like concepts, and it's already outdated, and what we have to start doing is feed forward. And that's how we're going to get to the future, is by feed forward. What does feedback mean? Well, instead of, you know, bouncing off only the past, you know, you after you've done enough pattern recognitions and gone under a certain level, then you can start bouncing off the future, you know, sort of feeding forward, doing experiments, for instance, and stuff like that. Experimental things,
more.
In other words, experimenting in the future and bouncing off the future rather than bouncing off the past. And media has gotten us to that point where it first taught us about feedback, and now it's going to, I think, hopefully it can possibly get us to start feed-forwarding.
It sounds absolutely wonderful, but I have a certain amount of trouble understanding it in any clear sort of sense. I think we have a wonderful language that we've developed in our century to make us feel sort of excited about what we're doing. And I notice that it gets more and more polysyllabic as time goes on. I mean, really, all I know about the future is what I'm seeing right here. This is now. It has been built, some of it already. It's being built. There will be more of it. But if this is the shape of the future, it's not so much interesting to me. But the fact that I'm seeing it right here and now is interesting. It is obviously an effort, you know, this whole place to look at the whole thing in a
this
much more
intelligent,
round.
This is definitely feed forward right here. This is feed forward.
Well, see, that's where I have semantic trouble.
This is feed forward.
I have semantic trouble.
Okay, but in a sense, feedback.
Okay,
let me explain one thing. Marshall McLuhan, in his book Understanding Media and some other books, dealt with understanding the media, and there were things that we learned from the media, things that we didn't think were as important as other things, that ended up being very important. What he's gone on to in the last few years, his latest book is called The City as Classroom, and essentially he now looks at the contemporary American city, LA, or cities like that, as a medium, and he is now writing about the cities in a way like he wrote about the TVs, and you begin to see other things are more important in the cities of today than we thought, just like things on television, things that were happening were more important than what we had suspected, and that it isn't always just the content, it is the media. And so in a sense, you know, with the city too, it always isn't just the context. It is that city's sort of, it as a media and how it functions that way and the perception of it. And then it gets you, and at a point when you begin to understand the city as a medium, and understand it, I mean, if you can understand television without getting hung up with the particular good and bad values of a particular thing, but really understand that medium. And you do the same thing with a city, then you get onto the next level and you can begin to anticipate what should happen, what directions it should come. And when you can begin to anticipate, you can begin to somehow orient yourself to go in those directions. And so in a sense, the media has taught us a lot. In other words, you can take what the media has taught us through people that have understood it, like Marshall McLuhan, and you can apply that to the environment or to anything. And so it has helped us in that sense. I mean, the media has helped us incredibly understand ourselves. And I mean, all you have to do is have someone point a video camera at you, and you start talking, and you look at the playback, and you've got to learn about yourself. And what the only problem is that the people that run the TV stations don't point the cameras at us more often or at everything and just let it, you know, and just look at it that way. I don't think they're even pretending that that's life. It's just, those are all little theater. They're not really pretending any of that is really life for the most part. I mean, there's no popular television series that pretends this is life. I mean, they're very upfront about that. It's
but
not.
But inevitably, there is a certain amount of inadvertent editorialization. We can't help but influence what we want to see when we're behind behind a camera or behind anything, or even when I'm listening as a musician to the music around me, as it's going to somehow show up in my own particular music is bound to be editorialized to a certain extent. That's natural. There's no shame in that. I suppose what you're feeling is that the people who are most in control of the time on TV are rather shallow, perhaps, and maybe not really thinking very deeply about what all this may be really doing to all of us, and perhaps it's not really their place to do so. That's the other question.
But still, can you imagine having gotten any political justice personally as a human being after the war in Vietnam, after Nixon and all that stuff, without the television of media bringing it to you every day for like 4 months? I mean, that thing, the Watergate thing, and I mean, it was political justice, and only through a medium like that could we have gotten it, and every day, over and over again, and the television is a medium that can do that, and no other medium can do that, give you that kind of justice on one level. It gave me that kind of justice.
But of course, it is, of course, TV justice. We have to remember that, too.
I thought it was pretty, I like that kind of justice.
Well, I mean, I don't mind it either, but it's rather like the bad guy gets his at the end of the hour show, too, you know. We had to have somebody at the end before the commercial comes, and it might not have been so cut and dried in a situation where the whole thing was dealt with in a little bit more of a less cut and dried kind of way. I mean, I don't think that I like particularly the man who left the presidency, but I don't think he was particularly ill-served by the situation, but after all, I think he was dealt like a baddie at the end of a TV show. I really do. That, I think, has happened to us. I think we tend to go very simply that way, and I suppose in a way it's a little bit like public hangings. I mean, media are media. Maybe one of the media of the past was a public hanging. They were a big offense. They used to have wonderful, you know, and the church suppers afterwards, and you had to buy tickets to see the guy get his, and all kinds of things. It was also, you know, a kind of show. But the basic thing about it, though, is that we're talking about what media is, or any of these things, is somebody initiates it, and somebody is watching, or somebody is listening. Paul Sills, who is the founder, really, of Second City, and who is a man I've worked with many years over the long, long time, and a very intelligent guy, says theater is somebody performing and somebody watching. And this was basically in answer of a question which was very prevalent in the late 50s, and that is that the real reason that theater seemed to be in such a trouble, it was sort of a little bit more abundant, you know, according to many people and the small audiences and so on, was because we were basically still dealing with the proscenium stage, that we really had to start thinking about, you know, thrust stages, theater in the round, street theater, what have you, and that the media, that the area in which the theater was happening would have such an effect that this would somehow revitalize the theater. So we accordingly built an awful lot of new theaters with, you know, theater in the round and theaters and thrust stages and theaters hanging from the ceiling and so on and so forth. And theater still had the same basic problem because it had somehow lost that equation of theater being somebody performing and somebody watching in the same kind of way that speaking is using your lips, tongue, mouth, breath, and so on. In other words, you're talking about a very basic function. And if you keep this line, it doesn't make a heck of a lot of difference whether you're playing what you're playing on a proscenium stage or hanging by your thumbs someplace off a flagpole. It depends basically that you have somebody performing and somebody watching. You have the initiator and you have the person who is receiving it. It's basically holding the floor for the time being. In the same way I'm holding the floor probably for far too long here in front of you, where you're sitting there basically listening. And the point about having a lot of time, when you've taken off a chunk of time and asked people to concentrate on that chunk of time, is that you're hoping that in that process, some of the changes that don't happen when it's just a quick conversation, I say two words, you say two words, might happen because I've asked you to have a larger parcel of time to concentrate on what I have to say. There are things that must be done and said and unrolled that take that kind of concentration and that kind of time and that kind of bearing with one. And if that equation of somebody performing and somebody watching or somebody doing something and somebody listening, if that is kept strong, it doesn't matter really what the medium is. And what I'm saying now is, if this is so, and I feel it really is, it doesn't sound like something to be questioned, but I mean, it could very easily be. You see, people talk about audience participation. Well, you do participate. You participate by listening. There are also lots of different ways of how this is done. If you're in a black church, you respond by responding after the things that are there. If you're at a political meeting, you do the same thing by clapping. These are all different equations as an audience and an initiator, because they are very much determined by the place and the time. This place is going to change a lot of those perceptions because we're dealing with a physically different kind of place to operate. Still, however, we're dealing with something which is just as ancient as time, and that is you out there, me up front. And that, of course, won't change for quite a while.
Speaking of time, we're getting near the end. I think we should ask for the last question, if there is one. And if not, I think we should make...
I want to make a one-sentence last statement.
Okay.
That I won't be happy until William Shakespeare's prophecy that the whole world is a stage actually happens.
Okay, I think one should say that Adopina and Richard Saul Werman will be, presumably, on the panel tomorrow. They weren't able to make it yet today, and that will take place here at 3 o'clock in continuation of this panel on whatever subjects takes up.
Thank you for coming.
Very pompous, us panelists up here saying all these incredible things. What we are scheduled to talk about is Arcus Anti-Critical Mass, and it's a kind of esoteric title to put on any sort of panel discussion, so I felt that perhaps what we should do as a starting point is maybe explain what that means in terms of Arcus Anti. And that term, of course, comes from nuclear physics, and it basically describes a phenomena that requires two things. It requires particles with a certain kind of quality about them. In this case, it means they have to be radioactive. It also, as well as qualitatively, it describes a quantity. A certain number of interactions cannot happen unless that critical mass is available in a certain quantity. And we can use that that term critical mass as a metaphor for some of the human civilizations, communities, cities that we have. When the critical mass in any community is very low, that is that the density of it is very low, then the number of interactions that tend to happen within that community is very, very small. If you can imagine an agrarian society with all the members of that society spread out maybe half a mile apart, information throughout that community tends to travel very slowly. Once you start making a denser packing of a population, then the information in that more densely packed grouping flows much more freely. And that's what we're trying to do in terms of building Arcosanti and building arcologies generally, is we're trying to make a denser kind of situation where information and ideas will flow in a much much freer way than they do in our existing open environments. One of the problems, of course, in dealing with that kind of metaphor is that we're talking about quantity, because generally when one talks about critical mass, one deals in quantitative terms. And we have to be really aware that besides quantity, we have to deal with the element of quality, because if we just deal with quantity, we get back into the same trap that the consumerist society has got us involved in, where we deal more with quantity than what the quality of the things that we buy bring us. In a way, the festival, through the intensity of the interactions that go on through this weekend, is a sort of mini version of the critical mass by bringing together at Arcosanti all the performers, the speakers, the artists, and a large number of the general public. We're in fact creating a critical mass that brings about an enormous surge in the energy that surrounds Arcosanti. And what we're eventually hoping to do is to make this on a more permanent basis. What we are scheduled to do is to try and examine how this process can be begun at Arcosanti and how we can continue to create this condition. What happens now is the festival happens once a year, and what we would like to have is the same sort of energies going on here on a more continuous basis. My sense is that one of the ways that we can do this is that we have to begin with basics, and that means a basic reassessment of the values that we as a society embrace, because our values really shape our environments, and then our environments shape us. And what I feel in order to get this idea going and to make it take off is that we must attempt to make Arcosanti a focus point which will challenge the artist and the performer. And basically, there's no greater challenge than to challenge someone's values and someone's ethics. And what we would like to do, I feel, at Arcosanti is to challenge the sort of ethics and the sort of values that lead us into the kind of society that deals in consumerism and speculation and segregation and greed and so on. So I feel that if we want to encourage the idea of this critical mass taking off and beginning to ferment some new ideas from Arcosanti, that we have to send out the word to all those people that have a commitment to quality in our lives, and let people know that Arcosanti stands for a set of values that challenge those kind of values that we've become accustomed to in our modern society. And we'd wish to challenge not only the artists, but you and anybody who's interested in changing those values to create with us a vision of the world as it could be in the future, because we are really now at a point when we collectively are creating our own futures. We have the ability and the techniques to create our future, but perhaps what we're lacking is the vision of what that future can become. So I feel that by challenging the artist in a very direct way and in a very basic way, that we can really encourage this explosion of energy at Arcosanti that we call the critical mass effect. And we have here on the panel several people who have responded to the challenge of Arcosanti by coming out here and joining us on the panel, and also doing some of the artworks. And I'd like to throw open the discussion to them. I'm sure everybody could introduce themselves if you feel you'd like to. Tom, would you like to start?
Sure.
You're nearest.
All right. My name is Tom Van Sant. I'm a sculptor and painter. And recently, 5 years have become interested in kites, and like eating peanuts, I couldn't stop. And so my role here, not only the pleasure of being here, but is also to fly some large kites, which we'll be doing over the weekend. This is my first visit to Arcosanti. I arrived last night at about 6:30, when the shadows were very long, and I saw it for the first time from the gas station there off the highway. It's a magic place. The people here feel as though they are active in their own destiny in this environment. And it occurs to me that the title for our discussion is Critical Mass. That implies the gaining of power when a structure, a relationship between forces brings that relationship to a point that it can exercise power. And critical mass is not only a time of kind of jubilation if you are seeking power, but it's a time of testing, because that's where most ideas begin to fail. They begin to die as soon as they gain power, gain a following, gain resources, gain respectability, gain all the things that they think they want. And the founder of that institution or the originator of those ideas may disclaim the positions of the institution, but the institution always seems to institutionalize those ideas, and they seem to, in one respect, begin to die upon maturity, upon receiving acknowledgement, upon gaining power. I think that is something to be considered. By the residents of Arcosanti, can fulfillment really destroy the dream or change it to where it's not that kind of a dream anymore? To me, right now, it is perfectly alive, perfectly marvelous. The people here are coming because they enjoy it. There's no prestige involved with participating or exhibiting at Arcosanti. Is just at the right place for everything to happen. So can Tab Hunter deal with success? Can Arcosanti survive reaching critical mass? May I pass the question then on?
At the risk of perhaps saying nothing of substance at all, we determined to make it spontaneous and not to write our responses, our talks. My name is Arthur Stokes, and I design architectural sculptures, and I'm building houses with friends in the San Francisco area. And I myself am interested in perhaps becoming a more permanent part of Arcosanti. I have to explore that. Maybe I have to explore myself in conjunction. But it does seem, as Tom says, a most wonderful place at this present time. But the question is not how to deal with the problems of critical mass, but rather how critical mass can be achieved. And my personal question is, how could I, as an artist / builder, relate to Arcosanti, made the placing of me on this panel somehow natural, although I'm not sure what I'm going to say next either. If artists such as myself or builders such as myself wish to make themselves a permanent part of and contribution to Arco Santi, what provision is made for that as yet unclassified type? And I think I'll just leave that as a question for a moment, and perhaps other speakers will respond to that.
Would you like to?
You want to say something?
Go ahead.
My name is Ruth Asawa Lanier, and I am from San Francisco. I'm a sculptor. And as a student, I went to Black Mountain College, which was an experiment in living and working, building buildings and working with artists. That idea began in 1933 and lasted 17 years. And when it ended, the idea was really over because the commitment was over. And so I'm very interested in Arco Santi because I feel that I wanted to see what was happening here and what the commitment is, what the plans are for how many years, and whether that commitment can last to finally realize what you really want, because you're in a period of developing still, and somehow, I don't know when that point of real success comes, when things begin to fall apart. And when I spent 3 years at Black Mountain College in an isolated community, isolated from the native community, and it was a very exciting time because reflecting on it, to try to realize what was really important about it, was the people who were there. And I think that will determine how long Arco Santi will remain effective, is the people who make it up. It's not just the buildings, but it will be the people who will be here to do the work. And I think what made Black Mountain finally end was that there were less workers than there were talkers. And I think that you have to be very careful about having a commitment to working, and you could have a lot of wonderful ideas, but if the people here are not willing to do the milking of the cows or harvesting or the kitchen work or mopping the floors, all of those things that don't change whether in history, I mean, there's no past or there's no future to that. I mean, it's always with us. And I think if you don't understand that, then this place won't last. I was so tired of living in the community after 3 years that I decided that I would never live in the community again. But I decided that the unit that I felt that I would like to experiment with was my own family. So we have six children, and I think out of that unit, it's still, I feel, having worked in the community, having worked in the city, and finding that the most exciting unit is the family unit, because you can have those who work and those who don't work, and those who pitch in, who don't pitch in, and if that mix, which is, I think, what critical mass means. If that mix doesn't work, then the whole thing will not run smoothly. And it's not that things should be easy, but every part of it has to be working. And that's why I felt that instead of trying to start another Black Mountain, which is what everybody says, why don't you start another Black Mountain? Such a wonderful period that I feel that it is too late to start another Black Mountain, because we talk about energy crisis and we talk about cities decaying, And we find that people are leaving the city. Enrollment in school is declining. We have surplus buildings that at this point in a city, we don't have to build new buildings. What we really need to do is redefine the use of these buildings and make them work in a different way for us. That's why I feel that the philosophy and the idea of bringing competent people into a mix, we talk about public education being so ineffective. It's because the mix is not right. And I think the important thing that we need in public education, because that at this point is where the most money is spent in this country. I mean, in California, we spend $8 billion on education. Half of the state's budget goes into education, and yet we don't have an effective program. So my feeling is that if we can fill our schools and make that mix, then something might happen. And if it doesn't happen, then hopefully the family unit is still in operation, you know, because I feel that our children don't have to have a recreation director, don't have to have a community center to go to. They take, we have one who loves sports and he gathers all his friends and gets the six pack and they go to a public park and they have a game. They have that every Saturday so that we don't have to spend money on hiring counselors and because they counsel themselves and they have learned in a way to work and be responsible, although they like to play more than they like to work. I mean, and that's what they say about us, that mom and dad don't have to. I mean, you can work 7 days a week, 20 hours a day, but me, I'm going to play a little and I'm going to work a little. So I think that they have the right idea about the right mix. And I think it depends on how big you want to get and how you can make that size work for you. And it's really what you want to happen.
See, maybe we could just get one last point of view and then we can start talking.
Okay, I'll make it short. Does this thing work? My name is Kate Maxwell, and I'm an artist in a very personal day-to-day way. And my specialty is psychotherapy. And the thing that I find to be of critical importance is how to help people be creative in a day-to-day sense. The people I see, most of them have lost their creativity and they've lost their sense of play. And when an individual has done that, then they need an environment that will support them in learning to let loose, to be creative, and they need to confront their own inner need to expand their limits, to enjoy themselves. Tom and I were playing earlier with words, and one of the words we were playing with was humor. Tom brought up the fact that humor is an old term that has two meanings. One is that fluid that forms in an injured joint that is needed to provide movement,
lubrication.
You have to have lubrication in your life. And humor acts as a lubrication for us. In any kind of an environment such as Arcasanta, you have to have humor. If you don't have humor, you limit your sense of play and you limit your creativity. So one of my interests in Arcasanta is how do people play here? How do you combine work and play? How are you creative in a day-to-day sense? There's, you know, you're doing bits and pieces of a tremendous structure, which is very exciting. How do you keep that in mind? How do you make it live for yourselves? And how do you keep alive your relationships so that they're creative and there's play and humor and just day-to-day enjoyment? I think this could be an extremely exciting community, and it takes a certain amount of awareness and work to keep the goals in mind and to keep a sense of humor and play and a creative way of dealing with everyday life.
We seem to have several different questions, maybe, rather than answers, and I guess that's always the first part of trying to get some solutions, is to find out what the questions are. It seems like one of the things we're talking about is not only how to generate a critical mass, but is that success going to be a danger to the community in Arcasanti and to the innovation that we get in this kind of environment? The other question is there a place for the artist on a day-to-day basis right now, and how can we fit those people into the present situation? Then the fourth thing seems to be that the work ethic, which I think we have pretty well down at Arcasanti right now. We have a T-shirt that says, work hard, play hard, tie hard, which sort of defines the philosophical ideas behind work here. And the idea of the family unit as community, I think what we're doing at Arcasanti is, in fact, restructuring the way the community is put together, but not necessarily restructuring the individual units of that community. We're rearranging the communications between those various elements of any community to make it easier for them to operate. What we'd also like to do, I think, in terms of education, is to make the city the education in itself. Many of our cities seem to forego the option of using all the resources that are available as educational resources, and we would like to do that here. And the other thing that you raised is very difficult to define. There's a very bizarre sense of humor at Arcasanti. Probably need someone like yourself to try and define what it is. But there is one here. But maybe if we would like to involve the audience here, there's nothing more boring than sitting and listening to a lot of people talk all the time, especially if you have a question that you'd like to ask and maybe you would like to lead off.
Sure.
Well, 100 ducks is kind of bizarre humor. We've been offered 100 ducks from a community down in Tucson, one of the developments down there.
They're alive, yeah.
And, well, right now, at the moment, we're exchanging video letters with two other communities. There's a community called Findhorn in Scotland, which is a spiritual community that was founded by a person called Peter Caddy. There's another city being built in India called Auroville, and we're exchanging tapes with them. And there's a networking community in New Hampshire called Another Place, and they're part of this video network. And I should really get Richard Johnson here to tell you what Arcasanti Humor is about, because he does a lot of very funny videotapes. But they all seem to revolve around ducks, which I'm not quite sure why. But that might be an example of the bizarre humor I was talking about. We have a lot of heating ducks as well that go through the buildings, and somehow they get mixed up together. The humor is very strange. I'm not a humorist myself, so I have a great difficulty in trying to describe someone else's humor. So that's the best I can do with that question. Unless somebody, well, Richard would probably. Yeah, right. Go crazy without a sense of humor.
Too much work. You've got to be able to play. Yeah. Is it the family that plays together stays together? Uh-huh. It's true. Well, this is a family, isn't it? In a sense. Yeah.
Yeah, Russ.
Some people wait for they just don't know, but the community that we're talking about is not just people here. There are 2,500 people who got this workshop, and with the staff here, it changes out, I think, about a 2-year cycle, 2 to 3 year cycle. Just about all the staff says, you know, the diehards stay on, but you count the people who can. But just about all the rest of the 25 or so people that are staff is you change out. It's about totally. In 2 years, you see faces that you've seen 5 or 6 years ago come back on staff. That you, sometimes they're expecting them back on staff. But they're there. And there's a loose network of people all over the country. Internationally, too, there's some people that I think are pretty close that are not connected to Canada. So be aware that Arkansas community means something more than just the people here. And that has very much to do, I think, it has essentially to do with whether or not Arkansas ever reaches a critical mass. I think depends more on the people outside that do have a commitment. Places that people that are here slaving away with adequate resources. The people outside there are going to put those resources together. If they're going to do it together, that can be the festival might help coordinate something that is really people working outside.
Yeah, I think that's important, to look at Arkansas, or in my opinion, is to look at Arkansas as a focus of all these different energies that are spread out over a large part of the country, large part of the world. And maybe by becoming a synthesizer of a lot of different activities, like you coming and doing kites and having the lasers go on, and that's a real neat idea that maybe came out of the fact that we had kites and lasers together that might not have happened before. So it seems to me that having a very clear idea that this place can act almost like a prism that will focus a lot of different activities into one, into a sort of transcendent kind of look at society where we can begin to change some of those institutions in our society that don't function properly or humanely or compassionately and try and come up with some better solutions to what is happening.
Another speaker was asking me, and I'm a first visitor myself, what becomes of those who have been to Arkansas? What are those persons doing in the outside world, so to speak, as we used to call it in Taliesin, where there was a great difference between the inside and the outside?
When we speak here of the outside world, when we're here, we speak of the outside. Most people, I don't know if I have a chance to answer, but most people, a lot of people come here and they're in school or they're between school of some sort. By the time they get here to the first workshop, they're going on to school. Okay? Then they finish school and get into some kind of professional career. And then they may or may not come back, and they may or may not really feel that connection to this place anymore. I think about many people that have been here and have no real connection with the place anymore. They just go on and do their things, and they have been affected in some way, but they're not really part. I can't say a strong 2,500 person group.
Well, Russell is one of the people that's out in San Francisco doing things for us all the time and is an engineer who works for us on and off and comes out once every few months, right? And also there's some networks being set up in San Francisco, on the East Coast, Michigan, all over the country. And in a sense, I suppose one could look at the critical mass happening almost in an evolutionary sense, that as this is sort of the germination ground here at Arcosanti, again, the focus, and all those seeds go out all over the country and spread the idea and spread some of the theories that are behind the concept of arcology. And again, I think this whole festival is a focus of that kind of energy that we're beginning to get into. But maybe one of the things we could examine is, in a way, that the role of the artist architect, because a lot of what is happening at Arcosanti is, in a way, a restructuring through the physical structure of a community, how that community operates, and that kind of changes very dramatically the role, particularly of the architect, but also of the artist. There can be no more of the traditional architect's view that you go and you build a building and then you call in the artist and tell him to decorate something. I think there has to be much more synthesis between architecture and art. And perhaps by encouraging that kind of synthesis, that would help to get get some of that critical mass going, that energy flowing through the process.
That's definitely true. I won't. You have a question?
That's a super question. I think the answer most of the time is no. Most of the time is no. It's probably possible. The art world of power and acknowledgement and endorsement, becoming a public person, a celebrity, moving in circles of power, traveling on airplanes from city to city on matters of great urgency. It's extremely seductive, as everyone knows. It's very isolated. You can live in a city like Los Angeles and New York and become very successful at that entire game and not know very many people at all and not be very happy at all. So I think it's possible after it's been done, because it makes its... you kind of have to do it and see that it doesn't really work. You have to reach critical mass as a professional. That is, if you started in that game and gotten into it, you have to reach the critical mass and find out that it's never going to explode. You know, nothing's ever going to happen. Everything that you do, you gain only the right to do some more of it. So you might as well get out of it and get into something that has a love in it. And there's an old saying, there's an old Chinese saying, the man who wields great power does not make a good gardener. So you kind of got to retire from the power game. Right. Well, I think you know what I was talking about when I was talking about the power in the institutional art game, where people are relating either to corporate power, to political power, political structures. All of my large commissions have been, as was characterized in an earlier discussion, they've been really contributors to supporting the corporate and political power structures, making what they already do, the influence they have on our lives, making it more palatable to us. And I think that's one of the reasons I started building kites and stopped doing that work as much, because kids like kites. They like kites more than they like bronze, you know. So I think the people that the people have had a lot of experience as artists who are attracted to this community. I think there's a wealth of people that would be attracted to this community, obvious by the people here. But they're people who have, like Ruth, who have gone through a lot of the dimensions of the art world as it's and tasted some of its fruit.
I'd like to add something to that too. You see a lot of young people here, and they, as a rule, I would imagine, do not have families. Most of them probably do not have children. They're free to move around, to go to school, to come here, to go back to school. As an artist becomes older, and I have a number of friends who are professional artists, they become more concerned with what Tom was calling power, but which may also be interpreted as financial security for themselves and their family. You move into a bit of a family phase, perhaps, and it takes going through that before the person is free to come back to this kind of a situation and perhaps to make kites. I see it as a cycle.
Some of these words, you know, they come pretty close to you after you've worked in the arts quite a lot, like power and security. And like the reasons are right in age, you may find all of a sudden this element of loneliness that you were getting very close to. That all of a sudden you've got to find a new sense of motivation if you're really going to be a I can think of nothing that will bring you closer to home than an association with people that keep you alive. It seems to me that if the artist gets out of the car, which he tends to do as he gets older, say he tends to, that he's going to lose the very thing that he needs most, maybe the very thing that he can get in a place like this, because of the human associations that he has. But there's where you transpire. You don't catch it all from up here or from in here. It's a give and take between people, it seems to me.
Well put. Well put.
Yeah, I think it's true that our society is probably morbidly concerned with security, and we kind of translate security into financial worth. And in fact, the only true security, I believe, comes from being part of a community, because when you have human support surrounding you, that's far more secure than having a large bank account or insurance policy. And I think that's why we feel it's important that by structuring the kind of environment that you live in, that you can promote that interchange between all the members of that society, allows the community to become much more cohesive as soon as you have that ability to interchange between one person and another. So I think that's why the structuring of the way we put things together is very important. Yeah, Virginia?
Can I? you want to respond?
Well, I was, I only talk from my own experience, but the faculty at Black Mountain at some point did not have even a salary. I mean, and I think the most I think anyone ever got was $60 a month plus room and board. And there were many, many years when they worked for $5 a month plus room and board, which gave them money for gasoline and a few incidentals. But I think that young people have to have that experience. They have to be in company of people who, they have to experience that with adults. I think maybe that's the important thing that young people are getting here at Arco Santi. And so that experience has made it possible for artists in San Francisco to give a lot. And instead of setting up a community, they took San Francisco, the total city, as a community where they brought gardeners and dancers, performing artists and visual artists together to use artists as workers, not as somebody who's going to help people express themselves, but artists as workers, as psychiatrists are workers, probation officers, counselors are workers, and youths, librarians are workers. Artists have never been considered workers. And by bringing a group of artists and gardeners and community people together, the young people have found that where they're rejected by museums and galleries, they can use the side of a building, or they can use the interior of the social welfare office and beautify that, or they could use the schools or the jails or the mental hospitals and work with handicapped children and work in the Laguna Honda, which is a convalescent hospital for the elderly, and work in senior centers and use the energy of those people who actually use those buildings, whether it is to get their welfare check or whether it's to come for a tea or lunch, hot lunch. These people are, we discovered that there are many, many people who are retired actors, musicians, and through the CETA program in San Francisco, we're able to hire seniors for halftime, and the artists would come in and do a performance, and then they would discover that there was a spiritual, a singer an actor, and they would take them and go to the next senior center, and they would then get them on the payroll so that they could have a little income and a little dignity, and the young actors and the dancers would get something from the elder citizens and elderly citizens, and then there was began to get a mix of old and young together, so that, and then walls could be the, and so that artists who would never get are not concerned with the pedestal. They're not concerned. I mean, they would like a gallery. They would like a museum show. But in the meantime, what they're doing is they're beautifying housing projects, and they're beginning to change the shape of the city, so that rather than each one of us trying to set up our own, thing, we use the empty schools and be the background for our activities. And I think somehow that has allowed artists and the gardeners to become politically active, because they have to get a truck from the city, and they have to find ways to make the government respond to them, to serve the community, which is ourselves. And I think libraries have gotten gardens and murals because when you go to the city and they say, well, it's going to cost $5,000 to remove asphalt, or in the backyard, and it's just full of weeds, then the neighborhood gets all of its resources, as we've been active in with architects and gardeners, they all come and we begin to change our own neighborhoods this way, so that while it still belongs in a way in the its government, I mean, which we are part of, I mean, we begin to take over our neighborhoods. And I think that then that makes decision-making, we share all that decision-making among many, many people, young and old, and we begin to feed our neighborhoods. And I mean, I know in Chicago, in the housing projects, by using housing authority land, which has traditionally been the tenants have never been permitted to use the gardens or the lawn, are now beginning to raise vegetables, so that in last week's newspaper, there was an article that said that they had raised in 1 year $200,000, and the tenants, who are welfare, you know, families, are now canning tomatoes, and they're beginning to do those things that don't change, have never changed, and those are the constant things. And we have to begin to allow people to do those constant things, like eating and sleeping and maintaining. Those never change, whether you're in the past or in the future. And somehow pickling and canning and making jam, and all of those things are activities that are cost-effective and make people feel useful. And that's, in a way, and those are simple decisions that each one of us can make on our own without permission from government or going out for grants to do that. And somehow we have to begin to do all those kite making and all those, you know, things that each one of us can be motivated to do.
You basically seem to be saying that it's a question of desegregating the city, so that one of the basic things that seems to have happened is the zoning and
that's right,
and the control system that our cities overlay on the structure of the city itself.
And as cities begin to, I mean, there's inflation, and like in California, we have Proposition 13 with the tax. We are not going to get those city services that were, you know, like the street in front of you or your sidewalk or all those things or tree planting. The people have to take that initiative back, because those are things that anybody can do. And instead of saying, no, you don't have permission, I mean, there is no reason not to have permission. There's no reason not to have a beautiful street or a clean sidewalk. I mean, those are things that we have to begin to do. And we have to start saying, we have to start teaching ourselves that we don't throw away a gum wrapper. We don't throw our peelings on the floor. We don't throw our cups around. We have to take it until we find a suitable place for it to be dumped. And we can't afford street cleaners anymore. We have to do all those things ourselves. And it's very, very simple to do. It's very practical.
It seems to be that we're getting back to the point where Tom was talking about the dangers of success, because in a way the dangers of succeeding are that as soon as one becomes successful, then there's a great drive to control the success by either internally or external forces that exist within the institutional structure of what one has. And I think it's important to really stress that idea of self-responsibility. I think that's something that we keep trying to put over to everybody that comes here. It was also very interesting hearing you talk about the Black Mountain School, the kind of salaries that people got there, because very much the same sort of thing exists at Arcosanti. And in a way, it's sort of a, I guess one could call it a commitment mechanism to the idea that one has to go through a readjustment of values to become part of this experiment that we're trying out. The question that's raised by this whole idea of the critical mass is, how can we integrate, say, people who are working in a normative situation into this sort of unique situation, because we have a little island in the middle of a society that has a whole different set of values sometimes, or at least that's how it feels sometimes. And how can we absorb all those people from that society without necessarily overwhelming the ethic that exists within this small nucleus of Arcosanti?
Well, you represent the individual, I think. Whether you're a group here, you still represent the idea of what an individual can do and the strength of an individual. And I think that an artist is always alien, no matter how many friends he has. I mean, out there in the society, out there in the city, you are isolated. You are not, I mean, you have the same problems. I mean, if you were an artist trying to work in the schools, you have the same alienation. So I think it's the same thing that you may feel with the outside community. I don't mean just Phoenix. I'm just saying that you are an idea, and I think that's...
So that
hopefully all the young people that go through Arcosanti will go out there and not feel afraid to be isolated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important thing that we learned at Black Mountain, was that we are going to expect our whole life to be, with confrontations of some sort, and we just have to adapt or flow or go with it. Mainly not to be afraid.
See, I don't know if we really, I don't know how much time we have. I don't know if we've addressed any of the solutions to critical mass, but we certainly...
I have one.
Oh, really? Okay, here's the solution.
It's not a solution, it's an avoidance, solution. I wish for Arcosanti that it never reaches critical mass, that it always stays just short of its aspirations, stays just short of power, stays just short of prestige, stays just short of financial independence. I apologize, maybe for it, but that is the optimum state of health for this. Maybe.
I think I appreciate the energy that you bring together. I think it's a very exciting thing to have everyone here like this, but I think that it would also be nice to have, I mean, you do it, but it would be nice to kind of spread this kind of thing out throughout the year so that you don't have it all at once. And then, you know, but I realize that you do have artists coming all the time.
No, Tom, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's the most wonderful statement I've heard for a long time. And that sort of overcomes that danger of success that you're talking about in terms of doing things. And considering the fact that we've always been on that brink and we've done quite well being that way, I don't see there's going to be any there's going to be any advantage in getting any huge sums of money. We don't need help.